On This Week in Enterprise Tech, 28 gigabytes of classified government information on a publicly accessible server, modding your gear is legal according to the U.S. Supreme Court, and the Internet of Things grows up. Quiet on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twyatt, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 242, recorded June 2nd, 2017. Ron Culler, IT Anonymous. This Week in Enterprise Tech is literally brought to you by Sonic, TWiT's 10-gig fiber internet service provider. Join Sonic's internet revolution as they bring fast, affordable internet phone and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Visit sonic.com/TWiT to sign up for service and receive your first month free. And by GoCD, an on-premise open-source continuous delivery server by ThoughtWorks. GoCD gives you complete control of and visibility into your deployments across multiple teams. Since GoCD is open source, you can download and use it for free. To discover the power of their pipelines, visit gocd.io/twit. Welcome to TWiT. This Week in Enterprise Tech, it's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm your host, Father Robert Ballasaire, the digital Jesuit, your guide to all things in the enterprise. But of course, I'm not guiding you by myself. For that, I'm going to need a little help from my friend, Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Although today, he's kind of a plague carrier. Chibert, you're sick in paradise?
Unfortunately, yes. The good news is the doctor has given me all kinds of good drugs, and I am healing. But I'm slowly sinking in the West because I'm in my home easy chair.
Well, there you have it, folks. Here on TWiT, we believe in better living through chemistry. We've got a great show for you today. We've got a guest that we last had on over a year ago who's going to speak to us a little bit about the importance of security as not just a thing that we add on, but as a way of enterprise life. But before we do that, as we always do, let's jump straight into the blips. Well, are you nervously watching flash storage prices steadily climb as a supply crunch reaches its second year? Well, if so, rest easy, or at least easier, because if Samsung gets its way, supply of flash memory chips is about to become much, much looser. The Korean tech giant announced this past week that they are in talks with the Chinese authorities to add production capacity to their factory in Xi'an, in which Samsung has already invested more than $7 billion. This is in addition to a planned $13.92 billion plant in South Korea that is scheduled to start providing flash memory in the latter half of 2017. This rush to capacity is being driven by record profits in the 3D NAND space. As more and more devices demand more and more flash memory, Samsung and a handful of competitors have been pouring money into 3D NAND production facilities and moving away from traditional flash memory parts, all in a bid to capture a share of the estimated $104 billion in the 2017 market. That's up 32% year over year. Prices have steadily climbed as memory parts become more sparse as production lines have converted to 3D. But by this time next year, expect flash happy days to be here again.
The Supreme Court rules in favor of the little guy after a seven-year battle. This all started because Lexmark is saying that you can only buy the use of ink cartridges and do not own the right to modify them after use. Their so-called shrink wrap license states that you can potentially pay up to 20% less for the cartridges if you, quote, agree never to resell or reuse them after you've opened the package. This landmark Supreme Court case, though, has huge ramifications because of the international side of the argument. The international sales detail came into play because impression industries would buy empty Lexmark printer cartridges abroad and then resell them in the United States after refilling. Lexmark called this a violation of its patent as well. This is also the thing that Justice Ginsburg got held up on. In her partial dissension, she agreed that companies should be able to retain their patent rights on goods sold abroad. This case has so many ramifications that Padre and I are probably going to talk about this a little further in the bites, maybe. But this change in the interpretation of the laws means that ink cartridge refills are now legal. And by extension, this also means that modifying routers with firmware like DDWRT is now fully legal. It also means that selling drugs cheaply outside the U.S. by repackaging them and so forth and bringing them into the U.S. is also seemingly now legal. They mentioned this on Twill just now, and this is a case that's going to have long-reaching ramifications.
Now, in the past few years, we've become accustomed to seeing sensitive and top-secret information leaking out of the United States government, be it from whistleblowing informants, a public data dump, a state-sponsored hack, a masterfully planned exfiltration covered by a DDoS, and a publicly accessible non-password protected server. Yeah, that just happened. This past Tuesday, the U.S. National Geospatial Intelligence Agency confirmed to Gizmodo that one of its contractors, Booz Allen, left more than 60,000 files on an unprotected, publicly accessible Amazon S3 storage bucket. The cache was found by UpGuard analyst Chris Vickery, who was scanning for publicly accessible S3 buckets. While government servers are usually held in a special Amazon Gov cloud, which automatically adds advanced encryption and security, Vickery found the cache in the U.S. East 1 region, which doesn't add that extra security. In the bucket, passwords to U.S. government networks, plain text passwords for government contractors with top secret facility clearance, security credentials for Booz Allen lead engineers, master credentials for a data center's operating system, and, oh, by the way, credentials for the usually highly protected Pentagon GeoAxis portable, which usually requires both a physical security device and a special terminal just to access. In other words, they didn't leak classified information. They just leaked the credentials to access to the networks that contain the classified information. UpGuard was asked by a U.S. government agency to preserve its documentation of the find, and Booz Allen, which received an $86 million defense contract just 2 months ago, has declined to comment.
This is an argument that isn't going to go away anytime soon. We had a blip a couple weeks ago about how this Swedish trained engineer, but not licensed in Oregon, note that, is using engineering to change the length of yellow lights to accommodate the additional time necessary to safely make a turn. Last summer, he was fined $500 by the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying because he was found to be practicing engineering without a license. While states require engineers to have licenses and pass exams, Oregon also requires a license to even discuss engineering publicly or even to say you're an engineer. This really makes me wonder if the Oregon State Board of Examiners for Engineering and Land Surveying needs to also post examiners in every coffee shop in Oregon to also levy fines to people doing napkin designs for new ideas. Sorry, folks, this is probably the stupidest application of antiquated law I've ever heard since the Ohio State death penalty for speeding.
By the way, I'm going to be living in Oregon for 3 months, and I'll be engineering the heck out of my time there. Now, when you think of hyper-accurate global positioning technology, you probably think of the military, governments, possibly resource extractors, and of course, farming. Yeah, believe it or not, but agricultural machinery giant John Deere has quietly created one of the world's most accurate GPS location systems for use in their worldwide correction network. The technology built into John Deere planting and harvesting vehicles uses dual-band refraction-corrected measurement and a network of paired base stations to correct for ionospheric distortions and allowed for unparalleled accuracy through solar storms and other RF events that can throw even high-end GPS systems off by kilometers. The system allows farmers to plant, seed, track, and harvest crops with an accuracy of less than an inch. Such accuracy isn't just good for the lone farmer, but it can be integrated with a management system to maximize the efficient use of land, water, fertilizer, and farm equipment. In other words, the green enterprise. That does it for the blips. Next up, we've got the bites. But first, let's take a moment to thank a sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech. That's why it was literally brought to you by Sonic. That's Twit's 10 gig fiber internet service provider. The internet infrastructure in the United States needs fixing. We all know that. There are too many people paying too much for unsatisfactory cable internet. But Sonic is doing their part to remedy that problem by delivering fast, reliable, and affordable internet, phone, and TV to homes and businesses all over California. Sonic's mission, and I really do mean mission, is to bring internet freedom to all with unlimited and uncapped internet. They deliver residential and business fiber-to-the-premise networks with gigabit connectivity in San Francisco, the North Bay, and the East Bay. Their internet service plans include 15 email accounts and 1 gigabyte of storage, personal web hosting with a new domain, and fax line storage. They even include a home phone connection with unlimited local and long-distance calling, and all of that for only $40 a month. That's right, $40 a month, plus you get download speeds of up to 1,000 megabits per second. Now, on a personal note, I have always been impressed by Sonic's long-standing position behind customer support and privacy. Their record shames other ISPs because they don't treat privacy as an option. It's not an add-on. It's not something that they'll maybe give you if you ask for. It's part of their DNA. It's privacy. It's service. It's support. It's Sonic. Now, by standing up for privacy-friendly and local customer support, uncapped bandwidth, and affordable pricing for all products, Sonic's customer advocacy is paving the way for a better state of internet access in America. So here's what we want you to do. We want you to join the internet revolution. Visit sonic.com/twit and receive your first month of Sonic internet and phone service for free. Plus, bundle with Dish and save $120 off your Sonic bill. Again, visit sonic.com/twit. sonic.com/twit. And we thank Sonic for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Let's go ahead and jump to the bytes. This is a continuation of something that we covered in the blips, and that is the fact that modding your gear is now legal, according to the United States Supreme Court. This has been something that's been going on for a while, almost a decade. We've talked about it a lot on Twit under the heading, the culture of ownership. In other words, do you actually buy the things that you own? And we've heard this argument from anyone from Lexmark to phone manufacturers about what you can and cannot do with the things that you put your hard-earned money down for. And the question has been, if I pay you for something, if I buy something for you, shouldn't I be able to modify it? Shouldn't I be able to do what I want with it? Or am I just leasing it from you? And if I'm leasing it from you, why did I pay you all that money? Now, this, in a nutshell, is what this decision is about. And as Cheebert mentioned, Lexmark has been sort of the poster child for this. Do you have the right to refill your cartridge? Or can they, with their EULA, their shrink wrap EULA, in other words, as you open the printer, you automatically agree not to refill it without legal penalty. And the Supreme Court has firmly come down on the side of the little guy. You do own it, and as the owner, you have the right to do with it that what you want. Now, Cheebert, we should separate this from the service decision here. Because, yes, you own something. And if you own something, you have the right to modify it. But Lexmark is still fully within the rights to say, if you do modify it, your warranty no longer applies.
Yeah, and that's something that I'm sure is going to have yet more decisions in the Supreme Court. Especially as we start getting into things like people wanting to put DDWRT on their Netgear or Linksys or whatever, Buffalo routers. Is it really modifying it to the point where it can no longer be supported? Probably to a certain extent, but that doesn't mean you also go and say, well, the hardware has been voided and so forth. This is a very, very old argument. When I was actually working in distribution, my boss was very public saying, hey, there's enough profit margin on ink and consumables, in those days ribbons, that if he could legally say you buy consumables only from me, he would be more than happy to give away the printers, because there's hardly any profit margin on printers by then. But the typical profit margin on ink is 1,000% plus. If you do the math on those little teeny tiny tricolor cartridges, it works out to almost $21,000 a gallon for ink. And that, my friend, is a lot of money. And that's what the printer manufacturers are trying to protect with this legalese.
Cheebert, this is not the first time that we've seen this. This is not the first case. In fact, I can think back to my childhood to things like the Nintendo Entertainment System and the Sega, which we knew they were actually losing money on the hardware in many cases, knowing that they could make up for it in the licensing fee for selling the cartridges, selling the games. Back then, there was actually a case that went against Konami, I believe, by Nintendo, because Konami was trying to bypass Nintendo for the sale of the cartridges. They were able to purchase the hardware for much, much less. And Nintendo said, no. We allow you to develop for our system for that licensing fee. If you take away that licensing fee, you can't develop for our system because we own the hardware. And in that particular case, the court sided with Nintendo. So what's different here? I mean, the printers are still sold by Lexmark, by HP. They still own the technology. They still own the patents. But why can't they say, look, we're selling this at a loss and we're making up for it later? What you're actually doing is taking away a business model. What's right. changed?
I'm not sure. You know, it's hard to read the minds of the Supreme Court justices. But Justice Ginsburg was a partially dissenting voice. This is a business model. And the reason why a lot of hardware prices have dropped so much is because they can make up the profit on the back end. Maybe it's software, maybe it's ink, maybe it's paper, doesn't matter. But what this does do is say, hey, you're buying a consumable. There is no expectation that is going to be required to trade in. It's not like a deposit on a pop bottle where you have, quote, have to refill or send it back for recycling. Now, I think this might have been different if the manufacturers had said, hey, return it. We'll give you a discount towards the next round of ink cartridges. My personal opinion is the overall greed, the business model where the ink alone, ink and toner, is the number one most profitable division at Hewlett-Packard and has kept that company afloat through the bad times. However, the world is getting away from that. Just look at Canon. Canon is now selling a line of printers which are actually just a shade more expensive than your standard box. But it uses just bottles that you can then take another squeeze bottle and refill. And the price per ounce of that ink is so much less. And Canon was one of the originals that were trying to go with this model, and they've decided, okay, we're going to go away from this. So I think the big difference is the economy. There's way more competition. HP is actually got real competition. It's no longer just I'm only going to buy an HP. It's now HP, Canon, Epson. Even Epson has gone to a new series of printers that have much, much larger external ink tanks. Lexmark, HP, I think you guys are going to have to follow suit because I think the market is pushing you in that direction.
Right. And of course, just a reminder, Epson is a sponsor of the Twit TV network. We have seen their Eco product with the little tanks on the outside. And I got to say, it's about time. I love those things. But Chiebert, let's take this a step further, because now that we've got this landmark case, I could see this being applied to many different cases of DRM. One of the things that I play with all the time are 3D printers. And there are several 3D printers out there that will, quote unquote, destroy your warranty or even outright refuse to let you print if you don't buy filament from them. So it's the same idea with standard 2D printers. We'll sell the printer to you at cost or at a loss, but we're going to make it up by selling the filament at a higher level. And of course, they justify it by saying, but our filament is higher quality, so we can protect your printer from suffering from low quality PLA or ABS. That's essentially the same thing, right? That's exactly the same case. In other words, this ruling tells those companies, you need to make the money on the sale of the device because we're not going to let you lock them in on your consumables.
Yeah, it most certainly does. And in the same breath, same sweep of the pen, the filament manufacturers are going to get hit by the same thing. Obviously, the guys on Twill had a great argument on this. And, you know, if you really want to talk about the legal portion of this, go watch that episode of Twill. Denise and company did a great job on it. The reality, though, is, yeah, there's been an artificial floor on the cost of devices where the profit margin is actually, in some cases, negative on a lot of these devices. And the expectation is, well, we'll make it up in the consumables. That's worked when you don't have a lot of competition, but I think the competition is driving this in a different direction. I think we're going to see the initial purchase of the devices get more on keel with what it actually costs to make it so that there's at least a profit margin on that. Just take a look at the Google devices. They were not heavily subsidized by the carriers. So there you go. This lawsuit is going to affect an awful lot of industries, and I think it's going to change a manufacturing model for the Western world.
I will be interested to see if this ends up being a non-issue, like it did with phone unlocking. You may remember a few years ago, Apple just vehemently said, no, you cannot allow users to unlock their phones, but they went a different route. They didn't say because we need them to buy X service, et cetera, et cetera. No, they said if you allow them to unlock their phones, they can do things that will interfere with the carrier's networks. That was the fear that they tried to sow to the court. Of course, the court said no, and unlocking became completely legal. And what, as it turned out, once people were able to unlock without fear of reprisal, no one decided to unlock anymore. I mean, there's not much of a use case. It just kind of became a non-issue. Do you think the same thing could happen here? Do you think now that this ruling has come down, you might see companies say, okay, well, we can adjust. We'll sell you the printer for 10% more, and then you can buy your ink anywhere you want to buy it. Or is this something that they keep fighting tooth and nail because they realize they will never make as much money on the hardware as they could on the consumables?
Well, I think it's more of, I'm upset about the feeling that I'm getting hit by a bait and switch. If HP was more upfront saying, if I agree to not refill those cartridges, that I'd get a discount. I don't refill my ink cartridges because I know how much some really cheap third-party inks can do to gum up the works. I used to repair the silly things. And repairing an inkjet printer is one of the most painful, messy things on the face of the earth, especially when you start getting into plotters and you have these long tubes pumping ink around and you slowly get hardening of the artery disease in your ink tubes as things dry up and cake and so forth. So you end up blowing almost an entire cartridge worth to clean out those tubes. I think we're going to start seeing the same thing. My personal opinion is, come on, guys, if you want consumers to agree to not refill, make it so that we can snap off a tab or snap off a label on the ink cartridge, turn those in when we buy our next ink cartridges for a 10 or 20% discount. I'd go for that. And, you know, I think a lot of other people would too. And I think it's going to go the same way as unlocking phones.
Now, it's interesting that you bring that up because I'm wondering if you get to a business model where you have Lexmark, you have HP, you have any printer manufacturer having two boxes side by side at the Best Buy or the Fry's Electronics saying, okay, this one is the unlocked printer. This is total cost. It's going to cost you $350. This one over here, it's going to cost you $150. It's $200 less, but you have to buy the ink cartridges from us. I think that would actually abide by the terms of the decision because you are giving the consumers the choice. Do you want to pay a little now and more later, or more now and a little later? In the chat room, we're talking about phones, and it's the same thing. I buy my phones unlocked. It means I have to pay a tiny bit more, but it means I can use them on any carrier I want, and I never have to unlock it. But it's a choice that I get to make. I can be an informed consumer versus buying a locked phone and then going through the rigmarole of trying to get it unlocked. Do you think we're ready for that? We obviously are ready for that in phones. Are we ready for that in printers and consumer electronics?
I don't think so, because right now there's an awful lot of competition. I don't think we're going to see two different SKUs where one locked, one unlocked. I think it's going to be an opt-in and buy a digital certificate or something like that, kind of like what Tesla does. You can go from the 60 kilowatt hour to the 75 simply by unlocking a license. I think we're going to see something like that. The bane of all retail storefronts, why brick and mortar is getting killed over people like Amazon, are SKU. It's inventory. Inventory costs money. You know, just look at how Fry's works. Fry's doesn't buy a lot of their material. They have it on consignment, and they pay the manufacturers their profit margin if it sells. Otherwise, it goes right back to the distribution center. So I don't think we're going to see two different SKUs, but I think what we might see is an opt-in. And I think a lot of people aren't going to opt in because, you know, they don't realize they can.
Right. Yeah, I love our chat room because they're immediately rushing to some of the worst case scenarios. JJ to the 4884 brings up the Keurig and saying, you know what? Maybe you could buy a certificate for the Keurig. Maybe Keurig could say, hey, this is the regular Keurig that you could buy for $99. But this Keurig over here, it's got an extra bit of software that will brew 30 seconds faster. Would you like to pay a premium for that? I don't know if we're going there yet, but this in any view is a good thing. Anytime you give consumer rights groups more tools, more weapons to use against corporations who want to lock consumers into their pricing strategy, that's always going to end up in more satisfied consumers. All right, let's go ahead and move on to the next story. And this one's a bit techie. We're going to go full on gearhead here and talk about the thing that makes the internet work. Of course, I'm talking about BGP, Border Gateway Protocol. And we now know that Google is going to abandon BGP next year. Google, they don't want to play by the same set of rules that the traditional ISPs and carriers have played by. And so they're going to be dumping BGP. To date, Google has the largest private network in the world. It carries about 20 to 25% of internet traffic on the fiber that they own, not lease. That's hundreds of global cache locations, 15 data centers, 90 points of presence, and they just continue to build. We know that their facilities blanket the global map, which is why we can have things like Google Fiber, because they can actually just stretch it out from one of those data centers and get very inexpensive access to consumers. Now, Cheebert, why do they want to dump BGP? We've complained about BGP in the past because it is one of these things that was built at a time where security wasn't all that much of an issue. But why specifically does Google want to dump it now?
Well, I think it's a lot of the work that hasn't happened. The working groups have been comprised of a lot of different manufacturers, you know, stakeholders in the protocol. And of course, people like Juniper and Cisco and Ciena and people like that have a lot of investment into BGP, and they want the new versions of BGP to be better for them. So BGP has become very large, very cumbersome. The reality is a person that knows BGP well can demand massive, massive salaries because it's – while everybody keeps saying, oh, BGP is very simple. I beg to differ. I'm sorry. BGP is as much black magic as there are any protocols on the face of the earth. The reality is a far too large number of internet outages are caused by people that don't understand BGP. If you set up your peering incorrectly, like for instance, my favorite example is I was trying to download some new scripts from Spirent for their AX4000 test tool. That literally was a server 2 miles away from me. When I did my trace route, I was going, why is this FTP taking so long? I did a trace route, and for some reason or another, the link over between the University of Hawaii and Spirent on the commercial side in a data center over by Honolulu International Airport routed me all the way through Chicago, Illinois, and then back. And that we found out is because someone made a mistake and they fat-fingered a BGP peering number. This happens more and more often than you would imagine. And if someone goes and does, say, for instance, oh, they use the out-of-the-box value of a BGP peer of 1, that puts you at the same level as the top-level routers. If that actually was allowed to proliferate to your upstream ISP and went out onto the global backbone, it would then take the entire North America and try to route it through your router. We've seen it happen. So BGP needed to change. BGP must change. I think what's happening is, things have to change. Google got tired. HiWeb in the chat rooms already mentioned that, yeah, that's why you test. But HiWeb, your an expert at BGP. AT&T has this huge amount of procedures and checklists to make sure that you don't make mistakes, that you double, you triple, you quadruple check. You have another second set or third set of eyes making sure you don't make a mistake. This is not the case at a lot of organizations. And yeah, hey, run BGP. It's a great protocol, but its time has come. Google is saying, we're tired. We're doing our own. We think it works better. We've got a lot of smart people. We've gotten rid of a lot of the baggage from BGP, a lot of places where you can make mistakes. We're going to go and do this, and I'm sorry, we're tired of waiting for you guys.
Right.
Will we see Google's protocol become part of BGP, or maybe BGP2 or eBGP or whatever you want to call it? Maybe. But anyway, that's enough of my rant. Yeah. It's the newer, greater Google says we think we can do it better. We're going to show the world we can do it better. It's up to you whether you want to use our protocol.
Now, I think we should step back into a little bit of 101 and do a quick BGP primer here, because people are asking, well, what is the alternative? The Google alternative is called Expresso. It's their Project Expresso, which is kind of like BGP, except it's secure and it has different levels of authentication to make sure that you're not going to fat finger a route, or even worse, maliciously reroute traffic towards your domains. Now, let's explain how BGP works. When people think of routing, they're probably thinking of what's going on inside of their switches in their network. That's the thing that's closest to them. Now, we know that that works by keeping a table of all the physical addresses, the MAC addresses of all the devices on a network. And so whenever you have a frame that enters the network that has both its source and destination, the switch can look at its memory table. And even if it doesn't know exactly where that device is, it will at least know what port that device is connected to the network on. And it could pass it to the next switch and the next switch until it gets to the device. Well, when we go onto the internet, that doesn't work. There's too much. The memory table that you would need to store every device currently active on the global network is ridiculous. Not only would it take an incredible amount of space, but we just don't have the processing power to sort all those packets really quickly. So BGP gives us a way, Border Gateway Protocol gives us a way to sort of have breadcrumbs. We may not know exactly where that client is, but at least we can shoot that packet off in the right direction. And then the next router and the next router and the next router can get it closer and closer and closer to its destination. It's an interesting system, and it's worked for years. But as Cheever pointed out, there are some fundamental problems with it, the biggest being shouting. In BGP, he who shouts the loudest and the longest gets heard. And so what can happen is if you accidentally advertise routes that you do not own or advertise routes that you're not supposed to have, you can still get that traffic. As you advertise the routes, everything gets confused, because now maybe you have two different servers that are saying, I own this route, I own this device. Well, what Google is trying to do and what the consortium of non-BGP companies is trying to do is to say, let's move away from this archaic infrastructure that depended on people doing the right thing, and instead move to an architecture where we can actually say, look, there's never any reason for a server in Iran to claim that it's Google, which, by the way, folks, did happen a few years ago. You may remember that outage. So, Cheever, did I miss anything? I mean, that is a super simple BGP primer, but that's essentially the problem that we're trying to get rid of. Get rid of a protocol that was around before the network was this big.
Well, there's also another hidden thing that's happening. With this new global routing protocol, they're calling it GAFAM, what it's going to happen is Google and their associated bigwigs are now going to be getting the vast majority of transit fees. We know some guys, Brandon Ross was one of them. He had in a previous life a job, and his job was specifically optimizing routes. You can do an amazing amount of things by using BGP and its routing tables to be able to move your data around in a more efficient manner. So, like, for instance, if I needed to go to Chicago from Honolulu, it might be cheaper for my upstream ISP to route me through Los Angeles, but the link to San Francisco is dramatically faster. So what someone like Brandon would do is he'd play with the routing tables and set up preferred routes. And we can also do that with things like MPLS. And I'm pretty sure, though I haven't read the RFC yet, that my Google's protocol includes an amazing number of similarities to MPLS where we can put preferences and things like that. But the hidden part is this is creating a revenue stream for Google that is going to be absolutely staggering because they're going to get, 20 to 25%, maybe more of the transit fees of the entire global internet. That's a lot of money.
Now, Cheever, let's talk about some of the ramifications of this decision. So we know that the GAFAM, this is the group of Apple, Facebook, Amazon, Microsoft, that is trying to get us off of BGP onto a more secure solution. They've already committed themselves to moving towards this technology, which means the ones who are not included in the group are going to have to build in some sort of bridging technology, just like we do with 6 to 4 or 4 to 6. That's not simple, right? I mean, this could break what we know as the internet if you've got this many people on the new standard and this many people who can't change.
Let's put it this way. It might, but the reality is this is a fairly well-known type of thing. Back in, I think it was 97, 98, Jim Martin, Helen Gary, Carl Auerbach, and I did a multicast routing demonstration where we used the MITRE software called RouteD. It was by router MITRE in those days. And we created this in-between gateway. So gateways do exist, and you can be absolutely sure that the big players like Juniper and Cisco and Ciena are going to have routing engines where they can plug this new protocol in. Because remember, protocols, even though they might have started off as C code, typically are not going to end up. It's going to end up at a very high level descriptor language because that's more efficient. So making changes in the high level for creating and disassembling these packets, because remember, it's all the same data. We're just putting different headers and routing information on there. They're going to have those modules out very, very quickly if they don't already have them out now. And the big boys like Juniper, Sierra, and Cisco all have huge, huge, huge routing engines. I wish I could show you some pictures, but I'm not allowed to take pictures inside the cable landing station. But as I walk to the Aloha Cable Observatory, there are just row upon row upon row of Ciena routers. And these things have the horsepower to route for an entire city, no problem. And there are rows of these things. So, yeah, it's going to be maybe a little blip. We might have a little bit of a downturn, but I don't think it's going to last very long. And when you have players that big demanding that you use their protocol, it's going to happen. What is going to happen is a learning curve. Guys like our friend HiWeb in the chat room, they're going to have to probably go through some retraining on these new protocols and how to optimize that connection for the gateway. It's going to happen. It's going to take a little time, but I don't think it's going to be as disastrous as you might think.
All right, we're going to have to go ahead and move on because we are unfortunately running out of time. Next up, we're going to be bringing in our guest. You know, this is my favorite part of TWiET. We're going to be speaking to Ron Culler. He's a CTO and co-founder of Secure Designs. But before we do that, let's take another moment to thank another sponsor of the TWiET Riot. Now, this episode of TWiET is brought to you by GoCD. It's the on-premise open-source continuous delivery server created by ThoughtWorks with comprehensive pipeline modeling that is the easiest way to view complex workflows across multiple teams with ease. GoCD can easily configure dependencies for fast feedback and on-demand deployment with its parallel and sequential execution. In other words, it offers complete customization for your software's individual needs, letting the tool conform to your process rather than the other way around. GoCD's real power is in the visibility that it provides you over your end-to-end workflow. No more guesswork. You get a complete control of and visibility into your deployments in real time across the organization. GoCD will perform tests written in most languages or frameworks, and their test reporting is so thorough and so detailed that it won't just tell you that your build failed a test. I mean, that's not a really useful piece of information. It tells you exactly in which chain set and on which platform a test started breaking. That's actionable intelligence. Now, you can also compare content across any two arbitrary builds, making it invaluable when troubleshooting a broken pipeline. You can do a before or after. GoCD is also fantastically flexible. It supports audible deployment. It lets you delegate the configuration of pipelines to users without full-blown admin privileges. And it has extension points that let you connect any of a number of ready plugins or plugins that you write yourself. The TLDR here is you can say goodbye to deployment panic and hello to consistent, predictable deliveries. GoCD is an open-source solution that you can download and use for free. Discover the power of their pipelines at gocd.io/twit. That's gocd.io/twit. Commercial support and enterprise add-ons, including disaster recovery, are also available. And we thank GoCD for the support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. We welcome back to the show Mr. Ron Culler. He is the CTO and co-founder of Secure Designs. Ron, thank you very much for coming back.
Great to be back.
Now, the last time we had you on This Week in Enterprise Tech was back in, I believe, February of last year, when you were on to discuss what at the time was a very interesting event, and that was the Jeep hack by Valisek and Miller. They were able to use the onboard internet providing tool, I think it was provided by Sprint, to access parts of the controller area network, the network inside of your car, to do everything from control the entertainment system to, quite frighteningly, disable the brakes, the engine, and the power steering. Now, this was a very early case of, I'd say, Internet of Things gone horribly, horribly, horribly wrong. Have we advanced much since February of last year?
No, not really.
Okay, well, thank you, Ron. Thank you very much for joining. No, seriously. Unfortunately, that is true. Now, actually, before we get deep into this, could you give our audience a quick refresher of why you created Secure Designs? Why is it important that we look into issues like this?
Sure. One of the biggest reasons we did Secure Designs was to provide internet security to really the masses of businesses out there, the small to mid-size, or what we refer to as the micro SMB. These guys are out there, typically don't have a IT staff on board. They've got an outsourced service provider. And in the last, say, 5 to 10 years, the amount of IoT-enabled devices that have been plugged into their networks is growing at an astronomical rate. It started, I think, with some of the multifunction printers and copiers. It's evolved into IP video, IP phones, controller sensors, you name it, it's all on their network. And the people that are installing this have no concept of what they're doing. So right. Somebody's got to be out there to protect them.
This is something that we've seen. It's a bit of a phenomenon that even has a fun name. We call it Shadow IT. And it's this whole idea as we get users who are more and more tech savvy, who are accustomed to doing their own thing on their own networks and bringing in their own devices, they just kind of assume that they can bypass corporate IT. I mean, if they can fix the problem, why should they call someone? Of course, that leads to issues. And you have personal experience in that. You worked with the Navy for a decade on identifying exactly these sorts of issues. What happens when you have a device let loose onto a network that nobody has vetted? What happens when someone brings in their phone and connects it to a network that's supposed to be secure? What happens when consumer electronics devices come in that could quite possibly be infected by malware or have APTs installed on them? What is your pitch when you come up to a CTO or a CFO who does not want to hear this? I mean, this is the last thing they want to hear, that potentially their IT investment is being wasted and that potentially their IT investment is useless because it's not looking for the right thing. How do you convince them that this is something they need to be concerned about?
Really, the big thing we look at is most of the IT designers or supporters in businesses today, they understand the desktop, the server, the PC. Those are fine. Those are easy. We understand how to patch things. It's all of the things that have been plugged into the network that from the IT standpoint, if you're a CIO or IT admin, you probably don't know those things exist on your network. They were brought in by somebody else. So when it comes to things down the road like compliance, More and more organizations have compliance issues, whether it's healthcare, financial services, PCI DSS. All of these things are affecting businesses. And if you don't know what's on your network, don't know how to fix it, don't know how to connect or manage that device, then you have to be able to do something. You got to get it off your network. You've got to be able to isolate this thing. That's what we're doing now with some of our solutions.
Tell me about those solutions. So let me give you something ripped out of the news. Right now, we are seeing a new push for the death of perimeter security. It's something that we know has been happening for a while. People are realizing that a nice firewall just doesn't do it anymore. You're going to get threats inside the walls. It's not if, it's when. So now there's this new push. We see it every couple of months of isolating, segmenting your network, putting everything into zones and making sure that there are permissions set to move from one zone to the next so that you can ensure that users are only getting the resources that they should have access to. But, and maybe you can comment on this, I've seen every time there's a breach or every time there's an issue, something like WannaCry, there's a flurry of activity about this, and then it just kind of dies off. The will to actually spend the money and the time to implement this new strategy always seems to go away. Is there a way to make sure that people actually maintain the zeal for segmented networks?
I really wish there was. One of the things that we see is, and one of the approaches that we're taking is going to the providers of these additional services, these things that are being plugged into networks, and bringing a best practice to them. Because honestly, IT departments and organizations are overwhelmed with just the day-to-day dealings of their network. And when you try to add on additional pieces, like let's resegment the entire network. Let's go through and slice our network to pieces and then set it up into secure zones. The amount of work, the amount of pain and suffering that those guys are going to have to deal with just goes away. It's far easier right now to get those devices that are causing you problems, get them off the network, remove them, put them out on an isolated segment, and then if need be, do some connectivity and some access at that point.
Right, right. And actually, we talked about this a little bit last week with Cisco announcing their new suite. It's specifically designed for Internet of Things, and it combines a few of their existing projects to create a system that will automatically segment Internet of Things devices into their own networks, and it will watch them for activity that looks like it's a compromised activity or an exploited activity, and then it will shut it off from the network. Is that the right direction? I mean, that is segmenting. Is that what all manufacturers are going to do? Because we've made fun of the IoT as the Internet of Own Things here on Twiat, and I know the industry wants to move away from it. I know the industry sees great promise in the IoT. Do we need something like what Cisco is offering, or are there other projects out there that could potentially help us secure IoT?
I think it boils down to just some foundational practices, best practices on your internet security. Not everybody's going to have a Cisco network. So the ability to bring that type of a solution into a small business of 50 employees is going to be next to impossible, just the amount of work involved in that. But simple best practices, going back to some of our foundations, the networks are still networks. What we're doing is not revolutionary, it's evolutionary.
Okay, now let me ask you this. It's easy to say we just have to assume that all IoT devices are owned. But when we talk about that, we're normally thinking about sensors. We're thinking we may or may not be able to trust the data coming out of these sensors. But grouped in with IoT are devices that have real control of real-world devices, real-world machinery, things like SCADA devices. We can't just segment them off and assume they're going to get owned. We actually have to protect those, because having those devices be exploited can have real-world consequences at places like power plants and dams. So how do you separate the IoT devices that are okay to get owned because we'll just disconnect them and then reconfigure them later, and the IoT devices that must be protected and cannot get exploited?
Well, part of it is really controlling traffic between devices and where those devices actually need to go. You have things that don't ever need to connect to the internet. They should never connect to the internet. But when it comes to things like the SCADA devices and stuff like that, there's some real issues in the protocol levels, and these networks were never really designed to be connected to the internet at all. And unfortunately, until the manufacturers of IoT enabled anything that's been, given a wireless, a cell connection, a 3G, 4G connection, or an Ethernet connection that was never connected before, you just became a tech company. So you need to start thinking like a tech company and understand we've got to put in security, we have to put in controls, we need to be able to deal with management and support and updates and things like that. The foundational things. They would have never been able to hack a Jeep had somebody that designed systems actually said, don't put these two systems together.
Actually, I love that. I'm going to use that phrase. You just became a tech company. And I think that can be a horrific surprise to many executives in industries that typically don't associate themselves with the cutting edge of tech. And yes, this story right here. So this was the Jeep Wrangler. And by the way, on Twiat, we interviewed Miller and Valisek. So we got first-hand experience with the Jeep hack. And this was one of those things where when they approached the manufacturer and they presented all their material, the manufacturer at first was very, very reluctant to talk to them because of that. They said, look, we're not a tech company. We don't do communications. And what Miller and Valisek had to do is to say, you've integrated all this technology. You are a tech company. You are a communications company. But the problem is you're not behaving like a tech or communications company. And so your equipment is very easily owned. Let me ask you this, Ron. The Jeep hack, it was kind of a watershed moment because it was something that was big. It was something that caught the attention of non-techs. It was something that caught the attention of industries that were starting to become tech companies. Was this a good moment for IoT or a bad moment for IoT?
I think it was a good moment. It was the beginnings of a wake-up call. I think the Miri botnet was another one that's a wake-up call. When you start plugging things onto a network that you're not quite sure who actually made it, who loaded the software, who wrote the software, is it just somebody's screen print, your logo on top of it? It's an issue. So, making people aware that there are systems out there that these things are that technically connected is really, really important. And fortunately for that, it didn't do anything terrible. But, the idea that you can easily gain access to certain things, especially now with the autonomous cars and some of the self-driving features, it's going to get scary if these guys don't pay attention and start taking this, looking at this thing as a real thing.
By the way, if there are people in the audience who don't remember the Jeep hack, a quick refresher here. When Miller and Valisek talked to us, they gave us some of their research ahead of time, and we actually did test out what they had done. They figured out that the Sprint device that was included on a series of Jeep vehicles always had it was within a certain IP range. That was what was always being served out, and it was always connected, even if the owner of the vehicle wasn't buying internet service at the time. And the only security that they had provided was to move the access port to port 21, which, as we know, is the port that's usually used by unsecure FTP. So they were doing security through obscurity, which meant that if you knew that, and if you knew the range of the Sprint devices, you could literally run a port scan against that those addresses, look for port 21, and get into vehicles that were actually on the road at the moment. That's how scary it was. And that was actually a great example of responsible disclosure, because they were able to go to Jeep, and Jeep, they just basically terminated the service. So those IP addresses were no longer live. That could have been a bad thing. I want to bring in my co-host because he's been chomping at the bit. I've been seeing him coughing up a storm in my my display monitor. But he deals with these kinds of devices all the time. When you talk about SCADA devices and the controllers for real-world applications, Cheebert's actually doing that. He's actually building that on the islands. Cheebert, tell me a little bit about your concerns for security of IoT.
Well, I'm going to raise the red flag. I think the next big one is actually going to be with solar control systems. So here's the big issue. Rooftop solar has one ginormous weakness. It's feeding power onto the grid, and a lot of the grids aren't ready for it. This is why you have limitations on how many people you can have per neighborhood. Well, here's the problem. If in aggregate, that neighborhood's going to be producing way more power than the grid can possibly handle. Grid stability is the holy grail of any power company. And if the grid's not stable, they're going to do something about it. And the way they do it is with a thing called a collar. And a collar goes and literally shuts off your back feed from your rooftop solar onto the grid. You know, even if it's a nice, bright, sunny day and you're expecting to make a ton of money for it, and it's going, oh, overloaded, hack everybody off. Well, there's a new protocol. It hasn't been completely ratified yet, but it's been had a lot of talk. It's lots and lots of testing. In fact, I'm involved with it, and that's called SunSpec. And the idea is there now has to be or will need to be a back channel that provides a way of ramping down your inverters so that you don't overload the grid. So instead of doing an all or nothing, now you're going to be able to crank it down 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 80, 90% so that you can preserve grid stability. And the people want to go and add it in with all kinds of different sensors so that we can maintain a stable grid but still allow you to have your rooftop solar. Well, the problem is it needs to be secure. And my call to arms for anyone dealing with it is if you are starting to play around with it, you are a rooftop solar installer, hire one of these young kids that actually knows about security. There's lots. JJ24884 is a great example. Someone like JJ should get hired to help secure these things because a lot of them are using power over Ethernet, and literally all a hacker would have to do is plug in to the an outside plug in that home on the same phase, or actually just plug into the home. And a lot of these controllers have really pathetic passwords. You know, the reality is security needs to be designed in. And Ron, this is actually the question to you. How do you feel? Are these smaller companies going to have to step up? Are they going to have to hire these talented young kids like JJ that have some security background? Is this must have, or is this something that, oh, it'll be fine? What do you think, Ron?
It's a must have. I mean, a couple of years ago, I did a conference where I was talking to some guys in the physical security world. And these guys were talking about how they're going out and installing IP video cameras, wired and wireless IP video cameras all over facilities. And these are government facilities. And I asked, you know, how long what kind of training, what do you give these guys? And we give them 2 weeks to understand the difference between a dynamic IP address and a static IP address. And my mouth fell open. I was just like, you've got to be kidding me. Who are these people? And he's like, well, they're electricians. So the people that are installing these things are licensed and skilled in electrical work or engineering work or mechanical work or automotive or whatever it may be. They're not technology people. And the companies need to realize that as soon as you enable something, you became a tech company. And if you don't pay attention, you're going to get owned. It's just that simple.
Wait, Ron, I get that. But playing devil's advocate here, doesn't that work the other way around as well? I mean, yes, if you are a company that creates SCADA controllers that are used to open and close valves at a water treatment plant, you have just become a tech company. You are a communications company. You have to make sure that you're baking in the security that would be expected of a tech or communications company. But if you're a tech company and you make devices to enable IoT, didn't you just become a solar company and a roofing company and a piping company? Doesn't those companies, the actual tech and communications companies, also have the responsibility to actually understand the industries into which their devices might be installed.
Oh, definitely. That's one thing that has really frustrated me over the last 4 or 5 years now in the traditional IT channel world, where, you know, 15, 20 years ago, if you needed anything compute power, any kind of computing in your environment, you went and talked to somebody in an IT channel. Well, the people that are delivering these systems now have no idea that these guys with all of this experience in networking and security and design even exist. So, you know, everybody needs to understand, the guys in the tech world need to understand that these things are being put on your environment, and you've got to pay attention to them and understand how they work. At the same time, you know, the industry needs, these other industries need to understand that there's a technical resource out there. You know, it's not just, I found something really cool and I've just created an IoT sensation. I'm going to be the next, you know, Ring doorbell. It's not that simple. There's a lot more involved in doing what it is you want to do.
Okay, Ron, let's get real practical here. Let's say there's a company that's it's a startup, it's Stealth Mode, and they've got the new fidget bobbit widget thing that's connected to the internet and will make your life immeasurably better and make them $1 billion. What are the things, what are the key things, as them coming to you to consult them, would you want them to know about the security that they have to put into their devices? When would you say, yes, this is ready to go to market?
I think one of the biggest pieces, they need to, just some really foundational pieces, good build practices, good secure coding practices. You know, don't embed passwords in your firmware. Understand, if you're not designing the firmware that is running this appliance, you're just writing an app that sits on top of it. What's your supply chain? What are the controls? Who's doing what to this thing? Where is it actually coming from? You know, if you're going to deliver a product, if you look at something like a Cisco router, Cisco writes the software that runs on that device. If Cisco didn't write the software that runs on that on one of their routers, and it was just made by some, you know, anonymous software developer in some ISV out there, then all Cisco is doing is a value add on top of that, and they could be vulnerable to those kind of attacks. Well, you know, foundational system design best practices. What are you going to do when you have an attack, a breach? What are you going to do when some of the software that you're using has a vulnerability? How can you fix it outside of, in the Jeep instance, shutting down the service?
Yeah. Cheebert, why isn't there a UL for network security yet? You know, why isn't there something, a sticker that I can slap onto something and say, look, it's had these found, we've had our code looked through. They know that we haven't done anything stupid in the code. We've had our device penetration tested. We've slammed it with traffic to see if it goes into any weird states. Why doesn't an agency exist to make money off of making sure that, that as Ron said, just the foundational things have been taken care of?
Donald Trump.
Okay. Explain.
Funding for federal agencies across the board have been cut. One of the things that got cut was a workforce development granting program at the National Institutes of Standards and Technology that I was going for, in order to fire up a coalition of 6 major universities across the United States so that we can trade students back and forth that in specialties that each university has, to train them on network security and so forth, with the goal of creating an institute specifically like Underwriter Laboratory, specifically for security devices, so that we could put a stamp of approval that, yes, this is this is a poor device for the home, for the office, for the enterprise. It was actually had the backing of Ixia Testing, Spirent, SonicWall, you name it. There's a whole bunch of people. I was actually traveling around at conferences trying to fire this up, and then trying to put the proposal together at NIST, and it's gone. Sorry.
Okay, and I see that. Okay, I understand that, and that actually I did like that program. I thought it had a lot of progress, promise. But this is not a problem for the last year. This is not a problem for even the last 5 years. This is a problem that's been going on since before we started This Week in Enterprise Tech. So it's not as if I understand your frustration, but it's not as if the problem has only been politically solvable now.
No, no. The reality is that the tech bubble burst and the willingness of the corporations to back it evaporated.
Okay, so that I can get behind. I can get behind, absolutely, because then that answers why when people say, well, the free market will create something like this. Well, no, it won't, because if the corporations don't have the will, if they don't think that this is actually something that is going to hold them to account, then they won't do it, because it costs money to do penetration testing. It costs money to make sure that your foundational practices are taken care of. It takes money to hire a consultant like Ron to come in and actually do the things that are necessary to make sure that you're not releasing another 10 million botnet nodes into the world. I mean, Ron, I mean, this is what makes it a hard sell, right? Because you're essentially telling them to be responsible, not necessarily giving them something that's going to make them money.
It's true. I mean, depending on the type of device and depending on what's being put in a network, you know, these things, you don't necessarily see, I'm making money off of this, my video cameras. I'm making money off of these devices here. It's hard to explain to an organization what their IT infrastructure, what their computing infrastructure actually does for their business. Most of the time we end up seeing a lot of times that, you know, people get money for the IT budget out of what's left over. You know, it's that problem child, it's that cost center. So, you know, explaining that it's a revenue generator is a pretty hard lift.
I think our audience would be right with you. I think our chat room, no matter what their leanings might be, they can all agree that there's nothing that is more frustrating than being told by an exec, by a CTO or a CFO, well, we'll do that if there's money left in the budget at the end of the year. They kind of want to scream and say, well, we're trying to make sure there's a company left at the end of the year, so maybe you could be proactive on this.
Yeah, it's really hard. I don't know how many times. I've never seen anybody in the IT world that's not, you know, underpaid, overworked, and undertrained. You know, taking the time to be able to keep the infrastructure of an organization running is immensely hard. And the people that do this are you know, heroes in most businesses. And most people have no idea that they even exist. You know, it's the computer guy. He's there to cause me problems or make my Outlook not work.
I think one of the phrases that I heard at a B-Sides last year was, breaches are actually incredibly inexpensive to solve until you get breached. And the intent behind that was, look, you can spend $10 now, or you can spend $500,000 in 3 months. What's it going to be? You know, it seems like a lot of money. IT seems to be asking for a lot of money until you have that breach that will potentially end your corporation. Chivert, of course, you working at a university, a government university nonetheless, I'm sure you never see any of this sort of politicking on IT.
Oh, no, never see it. I will say there has been proof that testing does work. When Internet Week and then InfoWorld, my lab has moved between publishers. When we started doing these large-scale bake-offs, what we basically did was go in and say, hey, if you're publishing a spec, we're going to go and confirm that. And you would not believe the number of devices that we've blown up, literally like popcorn. You're hearing the interface chips blow up. We actually set a router on fire. We did a lot of things. But the end result of 10 years of large-scale aggressive testing and confirming those results has been a dramatic change in the specifications that you're seeing as a buyer. They came right into the realm of reality. In fact, there was a conversation that I had when Carl Auerbach was at Cisco for me to help design a unified set of performance statistics that could be used across the entire Cisco product line. Didn't happen, oh well, but such is life. Testing keeps the vendors honest. Having a testing organization is a great thing, and having an independent testing organization like what we did with large scale reviews did a great thing for the industry. Now that IDG is owned by China, don't know. Are they willing to go and invest in doing these types of testing again? Don't know. I surely don't see it happening in the enterprise. You know, they're just willy-nilly believing the salespeople. I think we need to test it ourselves. I think we need to be have a jaded eye. I think we need to go and confirm before we deploy.
You know, it's strange that the last part of the show kind of turned into a counseling meeting for IT Anonymous. I think we've all had that shared experience of just sort of staring at that executive and saying, just don't be stupid this once. Don't be stupid. And it never turns out well. Unfortunately, folks, you've done it again. You've wasted another hour. I'm saying wasted because that's how I enjoy it. Another hour listen to the best dang enterprise podcast in the universe. That's according to 9 out of 10 shadow IT folk. I want to thank everyone who made this show possible, especially to Ron. Ron, is there any parting wisdom that you'd like to give to our audience? Anything that you'd like to tell them about what they should be looking at? Perhaps how they have that conversation with their IT director, their CTO, their CFO. How do they convince them that now is the time to actually look at security?
Sure. One of the biggest things I think you can do today is explain that the ease in which anybody can access technology, the ease in which all of this shadow IT starts appearing on networks. From an IT services standpoint, you need to go after them and ask them for the money to secure those systems. So if somebody brings in something to your network, then go ask them for the money to support that. You'll probably end up with a fair amount of pushback, but at the end of the day, the idea that you're plugging something into my network and I'm going to have to be responsible for it, then you're going to have to pay and ensure that we can support that new technology that you just brought in, whether it's a manufacturing system or a CRM system or whatever it may be.
Ron Culler, the CTO and co-founder of Secure Designs. Ron, if you could please let our audience where they can know where they can find you, where they can find Secure Designs, where they could perhaps read up a bit more on the experience that you've had in trying to secure the world's networks.
Sure. Our website's www.securedesigns.com. My Twitter is Ron Culler, and available on Facebook, Twitter, and LinkedIn, and I think one or two others that I don't keep track of. So I'm around somewhere.
Ron, thank you very much for rejoining us here on This Week in Enterprise Tech. We'll have you back, and hopefully it'll be sooner than, what has this been, 16 months since the last time you were on? It's always a pleasure to have you on, Twyatt.
Great. Looking forward to it.
And of course, folks, we need to also thank my co-host, who is also the producer of the show, Mr. Brian Chi. He is the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. Also has recently received a degree for plague studies. Chibert, if you could please tell the folks at home where they can find you and all your research on getting sick. There we go. That's it.
ADVNETLAB. My voice is almost gone.
I understand. But you do have a solar system at your house that is network connected, correct?
It is, and it is behind an enterprise-grade firewall with a full IDS IPS looking at the stream and is in a separate zone.
Same password, 1234?
Well, of course.
Okay, good. Thank you. Chibert, could you please, if your voice is still there, could you please tell people where they could find your work, especially once you get back to work from being home?
Most of the work that I'm going to be doing when I get back home is not going to be public. But I am trying to go and convince InfoWorld and their new owners to let me do a nice test on DNS, especially with a security component. I want to go and revive the shootout concept, and we're trying to make it more palatable to them. So here's hoping. The reality is if you folks work with any kind of marketing budgets, What drives things like large-scale shootouts are ad sales. If your corporations are not buying ads in magazines, you're not going to see shootouts ever again. Sorry.
There you go. Of course, Brian Chi, once again, my good friend, director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. If you have any suggestions for guests or topics that you want on This Week in Enterprise Tech, he is our producer. So if you've enjoyed the guests that we've had for about the last year on the show, he is the man who gets us the guests. He is the man who makes sure that they're ready to go. And he's the man who really guides Twyatt. So, Chibert, again, we thank you, our super host and producer. And feel better. Or don't. Wow, that's holy
crap. Yeah, well, whatever.
And folks, we also want to thank you, the people who tune in each and every single week. We wouldn't have a show without you. We want to make it easier for you to get your enterprise fix every single week. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twyatt. There you will find all of our back episodes as well as full show notes for all the links of the stories that we cover during the top of the show and the names of our guests. So it's actually a very good resource if you want to find a topic that we've already talked about. But more importantly, next to all those videos, you'll find some drop-down menus. And these are the important buttons. Subscribe to the format of your choice, audio, video, high-definition video, to be delivered automatically into the device of your choice, your phone, your tablet, your desktop, your laptop, whatever it may be. Also, don't be afraid to share Twyatt with your friends and your colleagues. If you think you know someone who would benefit from hearing about some of the more topical issues in the enterprise world, then please, we're always willing to expand the Twyatt Riot. Also, don't forget that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/PadreSJ. If you follow me there, you'll see what we'll be doing for every week of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And you get to find out what I'm doing with things like water cooling rigs and super advanced computers and things that explode when you infect them with WannaCry. Yeah, that's right. I do them all here for the Twit TV network, both for This Week in Enterprise Tech and for know-how, and occasionally for the new screensavers on Saturday. Actually, that was just a doge I saw in the car. I also want to thank everyone here who makes this show possible, to the engineers, to Lisa and Leo, of course, who have allowed us to continue doing This Week in Enterprise Tech every single week, and to my TD. That's right, folks. It's Kevin, the Shark Man himself. Kevin, could you tell the folks what it is that you do here at Twit?
I have one cup of coffee a day at most. I don't have more than one, but I make sure it is used.
Well, Kevin, this is the time when we offer you a chance at redemption. We give you a question about something that was discussed during the show and see if you get it right. And in this particular case, when we're talking about BGP, we're not talking about ports. And in a typical network, how many ports are there?
Four.
Oh, I'm sorry. That was so close. The answer was 65,536. But we thank you for playing. And my friend, we'll try to get you next time. Until then, I'm Father Robert Ballester, the digital Jesuit, saying, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep Twyatt.